are turned on.
Okay.
And if you would turn off all your electronic devices, we would appreciate that. Now, this morning, we are going to be talking, is brotherhood practical? Now, we're going to look at this from two points of view, his and mine. You're my buddy. All right. We'd like to bring your attention to our bulletin, which is found as you leave this room. And in that are found our schedule for, we're in June, and this is June 1st, and we begin practical theosophy. And is brotherhood practical? Now, we also meet on Wednesday evenings from 7:45 to 9 p.m. During that time, we are studying together the Ocean of Theosophy, which has, we like to say, a synthesis of the secret doctrine, but I don't think so. It just gives you the main ideas in which you can begin to explore and to look into the secret doctrine. Now, as you know, this class starts at 11 a.m. and lasts till 12 noon on Wednesdays from 7:45 to 9 p.m. Now, we who consider ourselves theosophists, we have declared something. And we have written it down. And we keep on reading it to ourselves to remind us of how we so declared this. But the declaration of this lodge and all other United Lodge of Theosophists, the policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis, and it aims to disseminate this idea amongst theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves, by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. Now, after saying that and reading that, if you wish to become part of that declaration and so declare, we have an associate cards that are found at the desk. And they simply state, being in sympathy with the purpose of this lodge, as set forth in its declaration, I hereby record my desire to be enrolled as an associate. It being understood that such association calls for no obligation on my part other than that which I myself determine. Well, on that note, is universal brotherhood, is that practical? And we'll begin.
We'll begin. We'd like to begin by saying, Philadelphia, manito. Now, maybe some of you have never heard that before. Maybe you haven't really looked carefully at the municipal trucks, but it's on the trucks and it's on the flag. We have a municipal flag. And it's a wonderful saying. And Philadelphia manito means let brotherly love endure. So we were really, we felt really good reading that, because that's it's good to have such a high and lofty motto. But today's topic is this practical? Well, we can start by looking at unbrotherliness, which we see everywhere. We see it everywhere, especially in the hot spots around the world now. And we find that these internecine battles, because that's what they are, they're all family squabbles, because we are all one family. They've been going on for thousands and thousands of years, and we are in the Kali Yuga, the Dark Age, and we have been for 5,000 years. We were in a golden age before, where brotherhood was evident. But now, it is still evident, but we also see many examples of unbrotherliness. Now, is unbrotherliness practical? Well, we think not. One of the three objects, the first of the three objects of the theosophical movement is to form a nucleus of universal brotherhood. That is, to make it a living power in our lives. Now, by making it a living power in our lives, we keep it spiritually, mentally, we keep spiritually, mentally, and physically alive, because real wholeness and sanity are brought about through the inner realization and daily practice of brotherliness in thought, word, and deeds. Now, conversely, selfishness sows the seeds of insanity, whether in this life or in some other life, because every thought is a seed. So if we have unbrotherly thoughts, we are sowing seeds. And they are seeds of insanity. The lack of recognition that we are all brothers is at the very root of all ills. So how is brotherliness spread? Well, by cultivating joy and happiness. And we all know people that are blissful, they're joyful, they're a joy to be around, and we love being in their company, because they spread joy and happiness. And it's something that we should try to do. It may be difficult at first, but with practice, it gets easier and easier. So when a man is happy and contented, he radiates joy, is generous, kind-hearted, and optimistic. Ananda, or real joy and bliss, is requisite for a real spiritual life. And caring for all without distinction is rooted in equanimity. So we need to get over our personal pain, sorrows, sufferings, realizing that karma, which literally means action, so every action has a reaction. And if we can realize that whatever we're going through are really their lessons, and we're here to learn. The meaning of life, all of life, is to learn. If we don't learn the lessons, we repeat them. That's the twin doctrine of karma and reincarnation. We have to come back to the scene of the crime, as it were, and learn the lesson. And it just keeps repeating itself until the lesson learns, and then the necessity ceases. So we can be joyful and happy and not worry about what's happening to us, realizing that we're powerful beings. We're not weak, miserable sinners. There's no reason to fear anything, because everything is transitory, and really everything is more or less a maya or an illusion. But there are necessary illusions for us to learn and evolve. So if we become impersonal and we realize the third fundamental proposition, which states in part that the fundamental identity of all souls with the universal oversoul. So we are all one. And this is the first step in occultism, is learning the meaning of universal brotherhood. And as was read in our declaration, it emphasizes that the ULT, United Lodge of Theosophists, which is not an organization, but an association of students, and the unassailable basis for union is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, regardless of differences. And why do we do this? To help and teach others. It is said that when you plant a flower in your neighbor's garden, that a loathsome weed will disappear from your garden, which is a good concept. So we do get the benefit when we are brotherly. So we think it's very practical. Okay.
Well, if we look at life as being one existence and then eternity, yes, it doesn't seem practical. However, when we learn that we reincarnate again and again and again, as it was stated, we're followed by our old actions. They haunt us. And only on this plane can we place them back in balance. Well, what does that have to do with brotherhood? Well, if we consider for a moment that here we are sitting in this room, we're breathing in air or life, and we seem to be submerged in this clear space that seems to surround us. All of us, not just one, but we all live in this space. And we are told that being a ray of that great sun, that idea of a eternalist, boundless, immutable, and omnipresent principle that is dwarfed by any expression, because it is that. And we all live in that. It has become our arena for learning, or our arena for exposure, or our place to bring back harmony and bring back peace on earth. But the realization has to be your own. It can't be any kind of phrase that we may say up here that will say, right. Mm-hmm. No, you have to understand for yourself that we are all a ray from that one sun. That analogy is used over and over again. Because what is the light in each one of us? It is self-consciousness. And you look in someone else's eyes and you know the light is there. So that in itself helps us identify with each other. Now the problem that unfolds is our karma, our effects that we have set up in the past. So the only thing we can do is live in the moment, not live in the past, not live in the future, but be ever vigilant. I happened to be up in the kitchen in this building, and I my eyes caught this on the wall. Someone seems to be sticking things up there all the time. So this little thing with an acorn. It says, "We have power over nothing but the is. It is by working with present conditions that the nature of the future is changed, and in no other way." That speaks to all of us. And there's something in all of us that identifies with that. Our humanity, our compassion, our love, that we know exist. We have children, we love them, we love them, we love them beyond all love. But there's a point when that love has to change. They need to find for themselves the answers for life or to life, as we did. It's a journey for all of us to realize that we are one and the same. We only differ in degree. You know, I'm having thoughts, and they're radiating out. But what makes them strong is because the minds are receptive to those ideas, and they are strongly magnetized by those ideas. And the more one immerses oneself in this truth, the more one spiritualizes themselves. And what does that mean? Well, you begin to look at life differently. You begin to see how selfish we are in the smallest ways. And, you know, all the, great feelings of pride and stuff that we do, that's, and then you look and you're going, wow, I did it for that reason. That wasn't the only reason, but that was there. And you become profoundly changed when you are face to face with your own nature. And once we realize that this body lasts but for a short time, and its lives go back into nature, there's that aspect of us that never dies, that is eternal, that is here on earth, in the embodiment of every human being, is God, or it is the deity, it is the supreme, unknowable oneness. And once you close your eyes and stop the chatter and find that stillness that lies within, that unchanging witness to all the change. We all can do that. We all do that. We constantly do it. Otherwise, you couldn't be successful. Not in this world. You have to be self-reflective. And that is the hardest thing. Because how can I look at myself? Because I have all these false impressions of who I am. So once we begin looking, our friends, our family, become mirrors. And if we want to know where we are, you feel it amongst the people that are close to you. So, universal brotherhood is a fact in nature, because we look at molecules or an atom or whatever you have, an element, singular, by itself, but it knows innately that if it joins with another molecule, it will become stronger. It's innate. It becomes the building block of life. Everything comes forth from the same idea, from the embryo, from, you know, in the womb. It's all the same thing. It's all the same thing. It is all of life. And each kingdom below us sacrifices itself for that which is above it. And the blood and the electricity of a plant we don't see. But we know that some people live around plants and they just, hi. And other plants, bleh. And that's just another indicator. If you're self-reflective, you'll wonder what's going on. But we need not be too hard on ourselves, but we need to be honest. And that may be the hardest thing. And when our friends may say something that hurt our feelings, we should say, thank you. I didn't know I had that one. So we know we are all one because we come into this room and we feel better because we have lofty ideas. We raise up our consciousness. That self-consciousness, that light, becomes brighter and brighter and brighter. There's a children's verse. Children of light, as ye go forth into the world, seek to do gentle service to all that live. In preparation for this class, I said, where should I go? The secret doctrine? Where should I go? Go here? And going, I don't think that's it. Then I found the book that just touched me. It's called The Eternal Verities. It's written for children. And I do enjoy that. So, we're on a path of self-discovery. Theosophy has given us, or left signposts along the way, that we can recognize and use to our favor. And this idea of universal brotherhood is one of them. Well, we'll leave this open for questions, comments, tomatoes. Yes.
I guess I'm thinking about whether it's practical or not. It certainly seems to be many good uses to which we can put brotherhood. But you also wonder, do I really have a duty to be brotherly, or is it an option?
Well, I mean, everything is an option. Everything. You have an option for everything. But what is our duty? What is our duty?
Our duty is what is due others. It's a debt. When we have children, they're really debts. When we have friends and coworkers, and nothing would function smoothly if we didn't do our duty. And we see the results when it's not done. We see fights, we see shoddy workmanship, someone who works half-heartedly and not paying attention, they don't want to be where they are. If they're building a bridge, well, it could be big trouble 20 years down the line. The person might be long gone, but the defect is there. It may take a while to come out. So duty is a necessity, we think. It's, of course, just because it's necessary doesn't mean that we can't defy it. We can. We always have free will and choice. But if we constantly develop bad habits, if we constantly do shoddy work, well, it becomes ingrained and it becomes something that is done automatically. And so we may not learn the lesson in this life, but we will eventually learn the lesson.
Well, we're going to learn in this life. We're not going
to. Okay, all right.
Well, you know, this is the paradox. If you don't know yourself, you won't know anyone else. You must know yourself, but you can't stay there for a whole lifetime. You have to give of yourself. That light that shines within you, that self-consciousness, leads to the path of compassion. You know, and I think the Dalai Lama said, my religion is, or my philosophy is that of kindness.
And what was it? Thomas Paine said, my religion is to do good, and what's the rest of that? For the whole world, basically. He was dedicated to universal principles, and although he worked mainly in this country, his ideas spread around the world. Same with Jesus, Socrates, Plato, Gandhi. They were universalists. They weren't just trying to clean up their little corner of the world.
In the very back.
Where does love fit in with this idea?
Where does love fit in?
Love fit in with the idea of this brotherhood. Are we expected to love everyone that we meet? How does it work? What does love have to do with this?
It says you should love everyone. You should love everyone. But we know that's not a reality because maybe we can't love them as a physical entity, but we can love them as a spiritual one. That behind all that which is annoying to us is the same thing that's behind us. It's just that it has been colored in such a way, you know, that we think love is so many different things. And in the world we live in now, love is material objects. That's not love. Love in its truest sense is compassion. Love for your fellow man. I mean, kindness of the heart. That's how we touch each other. It's not through a smart phrase or something that, he's smart. No, it's not that kind of stuff. It's your heart. If you love everyone, you know, it's sort of a hokey idea, but you can love everyone. Now, when someone does something that is not nice, don't hate. But just go on. You don't need to interact. You don't need to put yourself in their presence. And if you are, just be quiet. Wait, over here.
You mentioned that the true state of joy is rooted in the condition of equanimity. How do you maintain equanimity in the chaotic existence that we lead?
Well, go for it, Doc. Okay. Equanimity, that's equipoise, being balanced, being unflappable. It's like our unassailable union that we have here. How do we do it? We think each and every one has to figure that one out for themselves. There is no one formula.
There is one.
What's that?
The Bhagavad Gita.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, there's many formulas in there. It's not just one.
Well, it's how to be equal-minded.
Okay.
Really?
Yeah.
Really. It's how to be equal-minded. And it's a personal instruction that we have left behind and that we see now just to rekindle in us that spark.
And how does the Bhagavad Gita end?
Tell me.
Do what seems best to thee, unto thee. That's what we have to do. So we're given all the instructions, but we still have to do it. We still have to figure it out for ourselves.
I can just follow up.
Yeah.
Does discipline or self-control have anything to do with any of that?
Discipline or self-control? Well, we hope so. It's if you have no self-control or discipline, you're... You've got a lot of problems.
Yeah. Well, it's also you have to remember that the universe is orderly. And that orderliness in one's life gives one strength. And that discipline gives one strength. That awareness of being equal-minded and not looking for the fruits of your effort. And always giving it up, not for you, yourself, but to the universe or to the highest that we have in each of us. It's you know, how could I do that? You know, you can keep it here, and it'll slowly change.
Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
I know this might seem off topic, but in my head it's not. Can you tell me what the theosophical definition of God or deity is?
Okay. Yeah, well, it's very interesting because the word God and deity express something limited. We use the word deity because God, in our culture, in the world in which we live, it's a being. It's something greater than us that's outside of us. And that is what's controlling our world and our universe, this vengeful, wrathful God. And we live in accordance with his nature. And vicarious atonement and, you know, born of sin. And, I mean, that whole mishigosh that is religion. Theosophy states that there is no religion. It's a religion, philosophy, science. And that it is a principle. A principle. So a principle in our mind, well, what is a principle? Eternal, balanced, immutable, omnipresent. Those ideas begin our mind to open up and to try to understand what it is beyond my comprehension. Because we can't comprehend the infinite with a finite mind. We can begin to understand its vastness as we stay to look at space. You know, space, the Buddhist monks are told to envision themselves in their heart and then to expand their self into space, into the universe. Just keep on expanding and expanding, expanding. And one, you know, becomes frightened at some point. I can't keep on imagining this. And it's very difficult to do. Because we can't not understand this vastness. But we know it through the laws which manifest through it. You know, and it comes forth. It comes forth in a disciplined way. And an intelligent way. And everything has meaning. And just because we don't see it doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
We think one helpful thing, at least for us, is to realize that deity is no thing. It is a principle. So it is always there. It is the rootless root and the causeless cause. There's a substratum of all, but it's even substratum actually infers material in a way. We think of strata on the earth. So it does boggle the mind when we try to think about what deity is. And mostly we're taught what it is not. It's not a, which was just said earlier. So it's eternal, it's boundless, immutable. We are rays of the divine. We are each one of us a ray. And perhaps after all this great round period of evolution and we all become one again, that we'll have a greater understanding. But then there's always more. It's ceaseless.
Yeah, all right. I'm sorry.
Well, that same question HPV mentions in the beginning of Isis and Baal, who, where, what is God? And the analogy she gives is you can understand a drop of water, you can understand the ocean from where it comes. The idea being that that equipoise, that center of the wheel, where nothing changes, where everything is infinite, constant, eternal, is in ourselves. So really, the only way we can know or answer that question is not by looking outside, but centering our consciousness, our awareness, our thought, on that in us which doesn't change, the self, the observer. And the more we dwell on that, the more illumination we have of what God within is, and by analogy, what it is reality.
In the back there.
Well, the topic brought to mind that when I woke up this morning, and decided to come to hear the lecture this morning, I could not have done it if I didn't have the cooperation of Universal Brotherhood expressed in my body. From my brain to my eyes, my ears, everything started working together. Breakfast, speaking to the family, and so forth. But I had to exercise a lot of self-control on the highway to get here. So it seems that we have to look within ourselves first and start with the smallest unit of our being. And when we begin to do that, I say, I'm thinking about it. Brotherhood is a fact in all of nature. And we as human beings, thinkers, are the epitome of that fact in the world, in the universe. And as long as we keep that in mind, we're going to try to cooperate and share each other's abilities. But like we said, when we got on the highway, it seems as though that fact is not accepted completely.
Well, we know that our minds are generators of force. Each one of us is generating ideas. Some ideas are weak, but the more we concentrate on an idea, the stronger it gets. And we begin by consideration of the idea and see how that idea manifests in life. It's just an idea.
That highway trip shows that it is a fact, because everybody was looking out for everybody else. They obeyed the rules.
no other civilization cannot survive without cooperation. It is all cooperation. You may seem contentious, but it's cooperation. Unfortunately, most of it's motivated by money. But there are those that do their best to be of service to their brother.
So before it was said that we should just give and give and give of ourselves, is that true when everyone around us will just selfishly take and take and take? Should we just keep on doing that forever? And wouldn't that just lead to us being exhausted of all of our energy? And is there a virtue in that? Or is there some kind of, you know, catch to that? You know, give and give and give, accept
Well, we could take our leave of absence. That's one way. But
no.
Well, it's no. We is it voluntary or not? Are these we have to examine the relationship? What these people are in relation to us? I mean, there's an expression in 12-step programs: don't go around the people, persons, or things that are going to bring you back. You can impersonally love everyone, including those people that are the takers, but do we really need to be in their company or not? If it's necessary, then we need to work it out. But we shouldn't volunteer to save the world because we can't.
Well, you know, Siskel?
I'm evil. One of them's dead, I think.
Yes. This idea, I'm sorry, what was your question? The end of your question.
Oh, well, I mean, it seems like you're saying to just give and give and give. And I'm saying a lot of times, you know, the people that you'd be giving to, like, are just selfishly taking, have no interest in giving back. And actually, by you giving to them, you're probably going to wind up causing more, something negative to happen.
Enabling. Yeah, you're. Well, that's very wise. It comes to that realization. But giving is what we do.
Yeah.
If we don't give, we take. And we try to give. But you have to give with compassion. And you have to give with discrimination. You know, you just can't give indiscriminately.
Well, I mean, that seems like the biggest problem is brotherhood practical. Yeah, it would be if people were selfless. But that's not really the case. So my question is, what do you do in relation to people who you know are not really capable of being reciprocal with us?
Well, we can't live for someone else. We can't tell anyone else what to do. We can't tell anyone what to think. Everyone's going to do and think what they want.
Yeah.
All right? You only have control over yourself. That is the only control you have in this whole world, is yourself. Your ideas, the expression of those ideas. You know, this is your life. So Theosophy is trying to give each of us a foundation to navigate this life and to truly know its meaning, why we are here. It's
like you said before, just to leave. What do we do when we're just stuck around people that, you know, are our enemies?
Well, we're all stuck around people that sometimes we wish we weren't, but they're there, and we do our best. And we try to be a catalyst for change rather than join in and be angry and unhappy.
This lady's had a hand up.
We have to learn to recognize that there's giving and giving. If you're talking about material things, giving some things to someone who needs them, there's a limit, obviously. But in a more transcendental sense, what do you give? And if we go back to the we talked about the difference. philosophers see as God is within us and not outside us, as Christianity and other religions teach. It seems to me one of the hardest things to do is to recognize that this spark of God is not only in me, and maybe in everybody here, but in that bad person, in that hardened criminal, or whoever, who doesn't seem to recognize that there is even a God, but that is still a human being, and that that person deserves the recognition that that person also has that spark of God inside.
We're told that all of life is conscious. That's what makes it alive. That everything is conscious on every plane, but only on the human is self-consciousness. And that is the light.
So a lot of the giving would be, for instance, compassion and love. No, things that you don't buy. Recognition, respect.
Yeah. The lady behind you had a question?
I was just going to say...
Can you speak up, please?
I was going to say that we can lead by example. And to some degree, that does have an effect. I've seen it in my own life, where I started going to a practice that just centered me. And I tried not to impress it upon my children that you have to do this. They then came to me and said, you've changed so much. I want to go where you went. And that's the education.
Well, there's an expression, talk about leading by example. What you are speaks so loudly that I can't hear what you say. So... And think about that. This man had his hand.
I just wanted to say that from what I've been listening to, the practicality of brotherhood lies in the uniformity of understanding, which is a paradox itself. When you look to the center for a definition of God, it's been my personal belief that it says in the Kabbalah that there were 10 that arose from the void, not 12, not 13, whatever. And as they moved to and fro, the breath of God traveled through them, and they returned, and the covenant was concluded, which basically means that there is one deity at the center. But creation itself was on many different levels, which is a paradox in itself. And the gentleman asked, what does love have to do with it? Love has everything, according to the Judeo-Christian definition of love. There's 7 different types, you know. The Hopi might have a different definition of love. Somewhere in that circle, which is a ripple, my definition of love might be over here, and yours might be over here, but in the uniformity of understanding, we might meet on a lower level of what our definition of friendship is, and then we can move outward toward our understanding of love. And as a lady behind me was saying that, I just think it's interesting that she referred to a spark of God. I was actually dead before and they revived me, but I like to say I look into the eye of God and I'll never be the same. And it's been my personal understanding that to become one with God, or what you may deem to be God, you have to give up that last bit of selfishness that is yourself, to become part of something greater. Now, you may end up as a pimple on God's behind or something like that, you know, but in order to
Yeah.
It's unfair about
it. It's, but in the sense, every time we die, we let go. That is part of dying. When the body no longer has the energy to continue life, life is no longer in it. So what is said is very helpful for us to understand this idea, because God is expressed in many different ways, but as a universal understanding, there is no God.
And there is no death either. Right?
That's right.
There's just, it's all one. It's all just a series of progressive awakenings, but it must be done in embodied existence, because after death states are assimilation. It's like when you eat, then it's digested. It's strictly digesting the experiences of the life last lived. And it's just with the life last lived. This gentleman has his hand up.
Just a couple of things. The one statement was said, from a universal understanding, there is no God. We don't know about that. We think the philosophy speaks to that God does not exist. But there's a difference between something not existing and beingness, just being. You know, it's not manifest, but that does not mean that it is not. You know, but also with the gentleman talking about, well, how much should we give, and is it wise to give, and all of this. A perfect example, we think a perfect example came up. Walter Cronkite was being interviewed some years ago. It was after his retirement, and we consider him perhaps a good example, or the world's best example of a reporter. And he was asked about the condition and the nature of news these days, and he said it's such a shame because the executives want to give everything that the people want to hear, and that way they'll get a bigger audience and more money for their commercials. He said, in my day, we decided what people needed to hear, and we were right, until that was taken by people who were out for the money and would manipulate it, and rather than operating from a basis of ethics and knowing what is worthy of putting out there, you know, now we hear things that it just makes you wonder, why is this on national news, some of the garbage that we'll see. So the message there is if you're going to be giving to those around you, you decide what you're going to give them. They don't decide what you're going to give them. And use that as a basis for your thoughts and actions, as long as your moral, your motive is in the right place.
And you will see the results. And that's what we call testing, checking, and verifying by applying these ideas, these truths.
It seems that learning lessons wouldn't make any sense to it unless there was some individual consciousness on a higher level that does survive the body.
You asking me a question?
I'm asking.
Well,
how many? And look like you're.
Well, in our Wednesday night classes, we really get into the ideas and that are presented to substantiate what we are, what that consciousness is, and that we have a septenary nature. You know, and that there's that knower that's unchanging. Because change cannot see change. Because it's changing. You have to have something constant that's a witness of the change. And there's something constant in us. Constant. Unwavering. Consciousness. Self-consciousness. So, I mean, all ancient philosophies talk of this.
That is the great gift that we have in the human kingdom, is self-consciousness and free will and choice. No other kingdom has that. The ones above have learned all the lessons so that they wouldn't act against the law. They know the law. They are the law. And those kingdoms below us, the vegetable, mineral, and animal, we impress them. And but they don't have free will and choice. Only we do. It's said that the gods are jealous because of that.
Well, we also have to, with that statement, where we find ourselves in this life is where we need to be. So what is our duty now, here and now?
I think what I was getting at is that if we truly are acting selflessly, we have a right to fight for what's right, and in relation to is brotherhood practical, I think that in this world it's not going to happen unless people are willing to fight for it. So I think the idea that you should give and have compassion and love for everyone should be an underlying theme. But in reality, we will deal with people who it would be better for us to be austere and harsh with them. And it would be better probably for their own well-being anyway than to just want to give them things in a kind of sentimental way that doesn't actually contribute to growth. And I think that, like, it's, you know, love, of course, it should be there for all life. But I think part of acting with intelligence implies making this decision from moment to moment whether to be merciful or to be severe. And that is a part of something that's necessary.
Well, we understand your comment. But we need to find that place that's impersonal.
Well, yeah, no, being selfless, absolutely.
Well, no, but where we're really just the witness of what's going on. Mm-hmm. And we're not judging it, we're just being a witness to it. And what our duty then becomes is what choice we make. And if it's not the right choice, one sees the result. And if it is the right choice, one sees the result. But that's not why you're doing it. You're just doing it. You're doing it because this is what you think you need to do. So you just are conscious of your actions. You're conscious of your thoughts. You're conscious. You're taking responsibility for your entire life. That's a big jump.
One quick one.
So just from my experience, this is much simpler. The thing of greatest value that I have to give is my interest and attention, and that is limitless. So from that standpoint, the thing of greatest value, that of part of me which is God, is manifest through my interest and attention. And so that's what I direct, and that's my gift.
Yes,
thank you. So we've come to the end of the hour here, and we need to mention a couple of things, or a couple of reminders. We have the Wednesday night study class in the Ocean of Theosophy, which will be concluding this month. The end of our winter schedule. Doesn't feel like winter now, fortunately. And next week, this month's topic is psychism and spirituality. Excuse me, practical theosophy. That's last month. Practical theosophy. So next week, the topic is the well-examined life. So let us examine our lives well in the interim and be the observer. It's always good to be the observer and to be observant. So everything here at the lodge is voluntary. Voluntary contributions of time, money, and service. All are welcome. No implication that there's any obligation whatsoever. It's all free will. Thank you.
Meeting adjourned.
That was okay, I guess, huh? What do you think?